Blog Talk Radio.
I'm your host, Polk Runyon, and tonight we feature a discussion on how to write a magical novel. And my very special guest will be myself, and I actually did do such a thing, and I even published it, and a few people even bought it and read it. Now, the novel, which was released in 2001, is called Drellmaster, D-R-E-L-L, Drellmaster, and it's still available from Amazon, and it's a 1940s-style mixture of sword and sorcery and science fiction and magic set on a post-apocalyptic barbarian world which has inhabited aerial floating islands, sailing airships, saddle dragons, wizards, ancient scientific super weapons, and, of course, naked Amazons, and all the kind of stuff that I loved from the pulp magazines when I was a kid in the 1950s. However, to give the story esoteric and philosophical value, I added Enochian magic, well, why not, and sex magic, of course, gotta have that, and yoga, and even an anti-globalization, environmental, not-so-hidden agenda, which has to do with the population explosion and pollution and various other things. It's contemporary. Now, my mentor on this monumental exercise was fantasy grandmaster Lynn Carter, who I had grown up with back in St. Pete, Florida. And one of the best features of the book, frankly, is Lynn's long instructive letter to me on the inner secrets of imaginary world creation. In fact, I can tell you right off the bat that if you're really interested in writing this sort of thing, this letter is worth as much as the book itself. So if you want to learn how to exercise your imagination, tune in and we'll journey to a strange world called Thun, where almost anything can happen except the ordinary. Now, we will take calls tonight. And by the way, one of our special guests, besides myself, will be, I hope, Ed Fitch, Colonel Rich or Reverend Rich from beyond Lemuria, Ed Fitch, who has also written and published a magical novel some years back called Castle of Deception. So Ed will call in from Texas and we'll talk about that a little bit. Now, the guest call-in number is 347-857-1830. I'll repeat that. 347-857-1830. Now, let's for a moment, let's discuss the rationale for talking about this on the Hermetic Hour, besides the fact that, and I did it, of course, and obviously I like it, and I did it, but there's more of a reason. I have to, well, you got to have a reason. There's more of a reason for talking about it. Actually, this although it's in the form of science fiction, and it really is a magical novel, and we have hermetic magic in it, and it plays a large part in it. And the hero of the story is a magician, and so it although we have a completely different environment, essentially the hero and the heroine, the rest of most of the characters, are what you would call human. Now, this might be considered a difference between fantasy of this type and out-and-out science fiction, because when you do a fantasy story like this, it's okay to have human beings that are just like us on another planet. You see, that's okay in a fantasy. In science fiction, they kind of expect you to, you know, do like Cameron did in Avatar and have them 9 feet tall and blue and you know, with different kinds of ears and whatever. But when you do in the fantasy mode, you can use regular human beings and just put them in this unusual environment, give them an unusual history, give them an unusual set of challenges, and that's acceptable in the mode of science, what they used to call science fantasy. It's kind of halfway between fantasy and science fiction. And I chose to do that because this is a Drone Master is it's a 1950s the sort of thing that you would find in a 1950s pulp magazine, and yet it has a great deal more in it that relates to contemporary situations and more adult realizations, of course, than they dealt with in those days. Now, the process of doing a novel like this is something that I've been active at for a long time. In fact, I started writing my first novel when I was 16 years old. I still have it in about 5 composition books written in pencil. A lot of it was written down in the public library in St. Petersburg, that same public library that Lynn Carter haunted a few years earlier. And I have this box full of these composition books, and the novel was called The Pirates of Borneo, and it was an adventure novel. It was kind of like Indiana Jones, although that was long before Indiana Jones. It was kind of that sort of thing. There was a treasure, and then a crashed airplane, and a treasure, and the Dyak headhunters, and all that sort of thing. And that was my first attempt at 16 years of age, and then I went on. I kept it up and kept writing, and finally I got a series of adventure stories in Argosy magazine, and I had and the Argosy magazine was the last of the what you might call the, it was a grand old pulp magazine, but by the time I got into it, it was magazine size. But they were the last magazine, national magazine, to publish male adventure fiction. So you could say, in a way, I was the last of the pulp magazine writers, because I had a series of underwater adventures that ran in Argosy magazine. I'll collect those together one of these days and get them out in a format. It's one of the things I'm going to do. But then, based upon that and all, I got two spy thrillers published by Pyramid Books. Night Jump Cuba was one of them. That's where we... this was, of course, after the Army, and I had some special forces experience, and so I'd been down to Cuba, so I did one about a rocket, a NASA rocket being directed by the KGB, landing in Cuba, and then we have to send a team of operators in the middle of the night to parachute into Cuba to try to get it back, and that was Night Jump Cuba, and that. And that did pretty well, and that came out. And then I got a sequel to it on the Cuban exile commandos called Commando X. And Pyramid published that one, too. So, well, having two of these novels out, I thought it's time for me to go either to New York or I can go to Hollywood. So I thought, well, I'm going to go to Hollywood. I don't like New York that much. And so I went out to Hollywood, and I was going to write screenplays, and I got with them at that time the top agency in Hollywood. And so I was writing away, and 20th Century Fox wanted to take an option on one of them and all that, and things were looked up, but they couldn't make a living at it. And so I went into industry and got married and made a good living as an industrial artist. But I still continued writing while I was working and building my industrial art career. So I got the idea about 1968. I got the idea for doing and. A science fiction kind of a story, sort of like one of the old pulp magazines, because I grew up with Lynn Carter, and Lynn Carter was the fantasy editor for Ballantine Books, and he's the guy that brought Tolkien over. I mean, Park Carter was Mr. Fantasy. He was a fantasy writer himself, published a whole series of fantasy novels, and he was an even better editor. I mean, he was responsible for literally creating recreating the fantasy genre on the paperbacks. So we'd grown up together, and he was kind of the leader of our science fiction fan club. And one of my friends, Dave Van Arnum, who was also a science fiction writer, they'd been kind of getting on me about, what are you writing this adventure stuff for, Polk? You know darn well you want to write a science fiction novel. That's what you want to do. So, sure enough, I started with this Drillmaster thing, and inventing this world, I let Lynn know, 1968, that I had this idea for this, and he was just really happy. He said, you're finally going to do it, So I said, I'm finally going to do it, but I'm going to need help because, I don't know, you've been at this, and you're the editor, and Valentine, and so tell me how to do this, I got my ideas, and I've got this world planned out, and I have a pretty good idea what I want to do, but, give me your expert advice. Oh, boy. So Lynn wrote me this letter. It's about a six-page, very, very compact, six-page, single-spaced, typewritten letter, which eventually became a textbook. It expanded eventually into a textbook, which I think you can still find if you're interested in this kind of thing. This thing's worth its weight in gold. It's called Imaginary Worlds by Lynn Carter. But the original of that was this letter that I published in the back of Drillmaster. And of course, it's Lynn's letter, even though it was to me. It's his copyright. But Lynn's letter. On How to Create Fantasy Worlds. And I'll read you a little bit of that tonight so you know how to do it. See, it's not difficult if you got a good imagination, and almost all of us that are, you know, I think all of us in magic, hermetic magic, we all have good imaginations. And so it's not difficult to imagine another world. It's fun, and you can do it, but it has to, when you want to build this world, make it convincing, and then share it with other people, you got to put some work into it. And this is fun. This is a magical operation in itself, building the world. And there are certain rules that Lynn found out in the course of doing this that will save you a lot of trouble and keep you from writing something that people can't understand or can't relate to. And Lauren read this and was fascinated because, of course, she's a Scrabble expert, and so much of this that Lynn's talking about has to do with names and how to create these names and what to do and what not to do in the creation of the nomenclature of your imaginary world. So, what kind of imaginary world did I create here? Well, I got the idea from a number of sources, and what I ended up with creating in 1968 was a world very, very much like Pandora in Avatar. In fact, if you read Drill Master, if you didn't know, it was originally written in 1968 and finally got published in 2001. You think I was influenced by Avatar. I'm not saying that Cameron was influenced by me, because a lot of these motifs are similar, come from different sources. But what I came up with some things that were original. My floating islands, which I have up in the stratosphere, and they're forested, and they have lakes, and they have people living on them, and they're and of course they have sailing airships that sail between them, and they have dragons that fly between the islands, and you can ride the dragons, and it sounds like a lot like Avatar, doesn't it? But instead of these islands being lifted by unobtainium, I came up with an idea that I think is a little more practical. I have a tree that I got the idea from the old banyan trees that I used to have near my kindergarten. We played in the banyan trees. You know, if you've ever seen banyan trees, they have a good big root systems that go all over the place. And I got to thinking, what if these trees had produced globes, membranous big globes, that had luminous, that had buoyant gas in them? Then they could pop up out of the ground, and they could float around, and that would spread the seeds. See, I mean, eventually they would pop. But what would happen then if these root systems would get to such a point that too many globes would get trapped under the tree, and the whole tree would lift up out of the ground and float up, and just keep floating up until it got up into the stratosphere, where it would finally reach its maximum buoyant point. And then these trees would sort of come together, and they'd drift together, and they'd gradually accumulate into what would be a floating island. Well, okay, that's fine. That's good. So I've got my floating islands figured out. But then, how do I keep my floating islands in some kind of an orbit? Otherwise, I have to position them, and they'd just be wandering all over the place. And so consequently, I thought, well, now, wait a minute. If I have prevailing winds, if I've got all around the equator, if I run a volcanic, a sort of a circle of volcanoes, then I can have prevailing winds. I can have I can have westerlies below the stratosphere, and I can have easterlies at the stratosphere level. So I can have this, these winds like this. And then if I have two moons, if I have two moons on this planet, I can hook the lunar pole up with the prevailing winds, and I have this volcanic updraft here coming around there. I can keep these islands very, very closely in orbit. So I started working on the world that way, and I thought, wow, this is great. So now I've got this thing. So I have this divided world here. So then I thought, well, now if I'm going to do this, why not have a lower level? So I have three levels here. So I created a bunch of lava tubes. This was long before we went up to Pluto's cave, by the way. But I created a whole network of lava tubes that provided me with an underground civilization or place where people could be. And then I created an apocalypse that would poison the surface of the planet so you could live underground or you could live on the sky islands, but the surface was polluted, radioactive, primarily radioactive volcanoes at first. But then I added a kind of a Chernobyl type thing, and this was before Chernobyl, by the way, over in the southern hemisphere, wiped out the whole southern hemisphere. And then, so I have this planet pretty much figured out. And then, of course, the environment determines the people and how the people are going to act and how they're going to, what they're going to, what kind of society they're going to have. So I end up putting the barbarian, the beautiful barbaric, warlike people up on the sky islands riding the Zarks. That was my name for my flying dragons. The Zarks and flying the airships. And they're very graceful, tall, very arrogant, barbaric kind of people. And then I have the little gnome-like people called the Oryx. And they have a worse version of them called the Trents that live down in the caves. And they're like little gnomes, and they have an old ancient civilization down there where they manufacture stuff. And so they're like little tinkerers down there in the caves, and they're kind of pale and whatever. And they make all the stuff that the Varkas up there on the Sky Islands use. The Varkas, of course, have contempt for them. And then we have a commerce in between, which is conducted by an albino race called the Moorgs, and the Moorgs are sort of cursed in a way, and they're albinos, but they can trade between the subterranean world and the old ancient industrial subterranean world and the sky islands. And into all of this, we put a strange religion. Well, of course, all religions are strange, one way or another. But the religion of the moons of Moria, the goddess Moria. But in this case, it's a goddess religion, but it's completely dominated by men. And there's a big sky island called Penderthan that's kind of the seat of the mortal consort, who's kind of the pope, and we have this. So all these goods that are brought up from the Oryx manufacture down below, these goods that are brought up have to be consecrated with holy water before they can, or they have to be purified, of course, before they can go up into the sky island. The church controls this. So I have created here a very interesting, well, I think it's very interesting, kind of a world. It has all its dynamics and its politics and all of this stuff. Well, then we have a secret society that's trying to unify the planet. And they exist off on this pinnacle of rock, which is way out in one of the oceans. And the pinnacle of rock goes all the way up almost to the stratosphere. And this outfit is called the Trimorphian Order. And they're kind of they're kind of, well, I jokingly said they were sort of like Scottish Rite. In other words, they're trying to get the three religions, because there's three. The Varkas have their Moria religion, and the Oryx down in the caves, they worship the demon Scar, the fire god. Then there is an ancient religion of sun worshippers who still hold sway. So the Trimorphians, the secret society trying to get all these religions to come together and understand each other. And they have an artificial intelligence who has three faces. It's sort of a bronze triple head with a supercomputer inside, and who's called Joscamore, which is made up of the three gods. And he is their oracle. And they have secret agents in all the different cultures. And then the wild card in all of this is the Mother Drell. And the Mother Drell is a huge, gigantic, mile-long air squid who's been sleeping for 10,000 years. And she is the mother, the blind mother of all these other Drells who are, you know, the size of, you know, ranging anywhere from 10 feet to 30, 40 feet long, like giant squids, except that they fly in the stratosphere, in the clouds, and they're dangerous. But the Mother Drell is fantastically intelligent, but she's asleep and she dreams. And all the other Drells are out there and are doing their grabbing people in the clouds and doing stuff like this. So then we have a priesthood that worships the Drell. And the Mother Drell is an island unto herself, and she has her own orbit, more or less. And she goes over the temple, down on the surface, over the temple of the ancient temple of the Mother Drell. And we have the priest and the priestess, and they have this Drell cult, and they magically contact the Drell. And they do this with sex magic, because the priest and the priestess contact the mother, and the priestess becomes possessed by the Mother Drell and becomes oracular, and so what we have here to get the dynamic going, we have the young son of the Grand Master of the Valadinian Trimorphian Order on the pinnacle of rock way out there in the middle of the ocean. And he has to go capture a princess for his bride. This is what they do. They capture princesses, okay? So, well, you know, it's anthropologically. Some people do that. And he has to... Now, this guy is a kind of a romantic. He's created himself... he's a magician, and he's created an air sled buoyed up by these Zerglubs, and he's trained these wild fire Zarks as a chariot team to pull his air sled. And he thinks he sees himself as the descendant of this ancient warrior Torogor, who he imagines that he's going to be the reincarnation of, or whatever, or at least from a romantic point of view. Now, the oracle, who has a devious plan in mind here, sends him off to wake up the Mother Drell, this mile-long air squid. There's a war that's about to start between the cave dwellers and the Sky Islands, and of course this is being fomented by the villain, and the villain Hrothgar is a half breed, half Oryk and half Varka, and he got kicked out of the Sky Knight Academy and all the rest of this stuff, and so he's got the Oryks ready to attack the Sky Islands. And Joscamore, the artificial intelligence, sends Brandoff, Prince Brandoff, to wake up the Mother Drell. Well, of course, in the course of this, he gets involved with his with his princess, Princess Lyra, who is a Varkan, and she is a sword. You know, she's a very she's one of these Amazons with a very good with a sword, and the two of them, you know, they team up, of course, and have a story. Now this is what kind of developed. And Lynn Carter thought it was a really good idea, but then he reviewed it and came back at me with essentially technical criticisms, things that I had. My names were too similar, and I had. You know, made a number of technical things that could be improved. So I want to read you a little bit of Lynn Carter's letter here, give you an idea of, now that you know the gist of the story here, give you an idea of how to do one of these things. And Lynn says, 5 December 68, Hi Pope. Glad we've reestablished lines of communication. Let's keep them intact. I'm a very visual type writer. I usually try to visualize every scene just as if I were watching an old Errol Flynn movie on the video. The bizarre scene, bright sun on harsh white stucco, orange and green striped orny awnings, the wink and glitter of brassware on the low trays, noise, bustle, stinks. The scene in the inn, low rafters, a dangle with hams and dried onions, roaring fire in a huge stone fireplace, with roast moofbar turning on the creaking spit, sailors with bristling beards and gold rings in their ears sprawling on low benches, wrapped in black cloaks stiff with dry salt, roar of song, scuffle of argument, rich smells, hot steaming meat, and spilled grog, etc. Wavering orange light splashing over everything, casting huge black flapping shadows on the walls. Oh boy! Now, I mean, this is you might think it's purple, but actually, when you read this, you can just see what he is literally what he's talking about. Now, I'll skip a little bit of this to the meat of it here. Names, all sounding alike. That is, all proper names beginning, being monosyllabic. And he's talking about the importance of names. I made a lengthy and close study of the problem involving creating imaginary worlds, particularly the problem of coining names. There are several pitfalls. One is a tendency to coin names all sounding alike. That is, all proper names being monosyllabic, such as in John Norman's Gore novels. You should be aware of this. Names in real life show an extraordinary diversity of form. Glance at the first page of your newspaper and you will encounter names like Nixon, Hong Kong, Uthant, Lyndon Baines Johnson, General Westmoreland, Washington, D.C., Paris, Spain. Note how they vary from one to three syllables, rarely more than three syllables. Note also odd combinations like Hong Kong. When I sit down to build a world from the magma up, usually, I sketch out my map, more or less designing it to serve the flow of my story and evolve names of people and places by the slow process. And, of course, naturally, I did a map for Trailmaster, and so I'm with him on that one. Hero names, if barbarian warriors, are traditionally bisyllabic. Siegfried, Conan, Thongor, Elric, Tarzan, Bantan, Kygor, Sheena, Jarel, Alak, or sometimes monosyllabic, like Kull, Brak, and your brand. Brand's perfectly fine. But not all names should be the same length. A wizard, god, or a mighty emperor might have a long, complicated name like Shara Jasha, or Adamanicus, or Clark Ashton Smith's, I can't even pronounce this one, Vormithadreth, or Dunsany's Zalrugarel, or Edison's Mazentius, a good one that. For variety, sprinkle a few longer names in your yarn. And of course he goes, he gets me on several things that I had in here. Let's see, I had called the little I called the wolf bat Zeus, and I had wolf bats that were really dangerous animals, and he said Zeus is childish and silly. Wolf bats are scary and fearsome. They deserve a grim and ugly name, and like Lloyd Alexander's Iron Hawks or Goanthlas or Burroughs Thipdars. Well, you're right about that. So I changed the Zeus to Vildax, which is nice and mean. He says, when I design a world, I try to use as close as 100 invented names as I can. One-third are people, including historical beings or gods, and one-third or more are geographical places, mountains, plains, seas, rivers, etc. And the rest are made up of critters, birds, beasts, trees, monsters, supernatural beings like vampires or zombies, herbs, plants, and spirits. Now, he goes on and gives numerous examples of this and how to really do it. So what ended up happening as a result of this, I took his advice. So I have a glossary in the back of Drill Mess. In fact, I've got a glossary in the back. I've got a history of Thune in the back. I've got a whole big section here on how I the influences that I used to create the thing. So really, what along with Lynn's letter, what Drillmaster is, aside from being what I think is a pretty darn good story, what Drillmaster is really a handbook. I'm not saying it's as good as Lynn's eventual imaginary worlds, but it's a handbook on how to do this sort of thing, and what goes into it. I'll read a few of these things from the glossary here. Gravandrakar, pre-cataclysmic empire in the southern hemisphere, founded by the lost tribes of Durvan. See the Myth of Moria, Appendix 1. The origin of later Golden Age Northern Hemispheric technology and industry. Gravandrakar was utterly destroyed by a huge nuclear reactor explosion 200 years before the coming of the Death Clouds. Amakwians, a barbaric proto-Varkan tribe living on the cursed surface of Thune in the area of the Mountains of Jade. The firstborn daughters of their kings are hereditary priestesses of the ancient Drell cult. And then we have Chuvars, a huge, ferocious, surface-dwelling feline carnivore, being an albino mutation of the characteristic white fur and pink eyes. Chuvars most resemble prehistoric earthly saber-toothed tigers. Also, the zodiacal constellation of the winged Chuvar, traditional ensign of the lost tribes of Durvan. The emperor of Gravandrakar was called the Chuvark. And you can see here that I created my own astrology. I've got my own planets, and I have my own zodiac, and you know we Thune does anyway. Now, a glump, a voracious slug-like creature that feeds on zir tree root sap, and on harmas root, the tuber of a radish-like tropical plant with purgative and emetic medicinal effects, a specific antidote for blood maggot poisoning if used in the first stages. Uh-oh, what's blood maggot poisoning? Well, let's find out. Nightwalker, an undead human corpse animated by blood maggots, a Thunian vampire. Well, that answers that question, doesn't it? Let's see. Keel butts. The narrow deck below the ballasted keel of a Thunian sailing airship, from which the keelsail, square-rigged keelsail, can be set and trimmed. In nautical slang, someone's arse, as in rammed in the keel butts. Okay, well, a little humor there. Salty humor. Now, a Myrian, a beautiful plumaged songbird native to the Sky Islands. What else have we got here that's interesting? All right. A scraw spider. A giant venomous arachnid whose under island webs are harvested for textiles and cordage. Let's see. The Urgs. Outcast, mutated, albino race of former surface world sailors and fishermen. They are merchants, air sailors, and tradesmen. They have no homeland and are considered cursed. They are allowed to live in ghettos with the restricted foreign quarters in Sky Island cities, but they alone are free to trade between the forbidden surface world and the Sky Islands. Their consortium is the strongest Thunian financial institution. Now, if you think that this is, that I'm getting a little bit politically incorrect here, I want to make it clear that all of the Urgs or Morgs in the story are all nice guys, including our wizard Hordage, who is the wizard and the alchemist, and he is an Urg or a Morg. And then we got Zalflowers, a mildly stimulating smokable, more like Savata than cannabis. Oh, that's nice. And let's see. White Warrior, a constellation of the Thunian zodiac derived from the hero Varkal, son of Varka, last of the 13 astrological signs, most of which are named for animals. So, this gives you an idea of what goes into this. And, you know, you can have, I know this sounds like a lot of work, but actually it's fun. I mean, this is, once you get into this, creating a world for you. And believe it or not, there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of exercises like this. If you belong to the Science Fiction Book Club, you will see probably four or five of these things coming out every month or so. People are doing this. This something's being done. Now, today, you can do it and publish them and at least get your friends to read them anyway. You can do this much, much easier than you could when I did Drill Master. When I did Drill Master, there was no such thing. Well, we're just starting to get into what's called an e-book. We're just barely beginning in 2001. We were just starting. So at that time, you had to publish. Now, with Drill Master, we almost got it into a regular publisher, but then they went out of business right before we were going to publish it. So I ended up publishing it myself and used a lot of my own artwork and designed the whole book and had a lot of fun with it. But it was also a lot of work, and not only was I a professional novelist and adventure story writer, but also when Sandri and I used to work at Rusko, I was running the publications department, so I knew how to publish books, and so that experience helped a lot. Well, today you don't have to worry about that. You don't have to do this big self-publishing or wait for a publisher to pick it up. Today you can do this whole thing on the internet. It's much, much easier. And if you're an artist, you can illustrate it too, and or get a friend of yours who is more artistically inclined to be your illustrator, and you can create, and you know, and who knows? I mean, even if just your friends read it, at least you're doing it and they're enjoying it. So I encourage you to do this. And by the way, magicians seem like they all do this. Now, Ed Sitch was going to call in tonight. He said he was anyway. He did it with Castle of Deception, and hey, Llewellyn published that, and hopefully we'll get that out again. But Ed Fitch did his, and Tyson did one on John Dee, I think Paul Clark, of course, does them. You know, he did that Dark Brotherhood, which is that's a cracking good story. The Dark Brotherhood by Paul Clark and Cindy Forbes. Now, we reviewed that a little while ago and had Paul on that one. So this is something that magicians really have fun doing. I would like to, just while a little time we have left, just give you a little sample of Drillmaster here, and I'll read you a little bit of the prologue here, just to give you an idea of how this thing goes. And let's see here, you're a good place to start. This is the prologue. Under ordinary circumstances, Drells were brainless beasts incapable of such a collective effort. But in this instance, the directing intelligence behind their actions was obvious. In the dark entranceway of the ancient temple stood a robed and hooded figure, holding and manipulating a multi-crystalled, varicolored wand that was the source of the vibrant humming sound and the scintillating colored lights. And having no other choice, the Sky Warrior and his chariot circled down into the wind and pulled back on the reins as he glided in to make a risky uphill landing. He kept a sharp eye out for protruding rocks that might puncture the buoyant zerglobes under the deck of his car, and as soon as the vehicle stopped bouncing over the ground on its sled runners, he tugged the blinders tight over the eyes of his animals and prudently waited until they had folded their wings before dismounting. The airman marched directly up the slope toward the magician, who stood waiting, silhouetted against the greenish glow of the open portal. The charioteer halted before the hooded figure. He made a respectful bow, but his amber eyes were narrowed, and the tone of his voice was edged with frustration. "Master Marku, you will always be my reverend teacher, but you are not my commander. You must know that I have other obligations." The man with his face hidden in the shadows answered in a hollow voice, "I cannot wait to catch you between your wars, Prince Brand of Valadine. I have little time left." He held the crystal wand high. It shone with an awful brilliance. "You are the only one who can follow me as master of the Drells. You are the only one who can awaken their great mother. And you are the only one whom I can trust to destroy that which I have become." And so saying, he threw back the hood and revealed his face. "Mother of the gods," Prince Brand exclaimed, "how did this happen?" "Charity," a Drell priest's rasping voice replied. He was completely bald, the dead gray flesh covering his face was stretched tight over his cheek and jawbones, and his sunken eyes gleamed with a feral light. Brand of Aladdin took a hesitant step forward for a closer look, but the Master Marcoux held up a withered hand.
"Don't come any nearer. If I cough, you'll be infected, and they want me to cough."
The young nobleman prudently stepped back. He had seen enough to know the worst. Blood maggots were swarming under the man's dead flesh. The infection had passed the incubation period. The master of Drow, Craig, had become a nightwalker, a vampire. The Valadinian prince knew that only the strongest will and the most righteous purpose could keep a faint spark of humanity alive in that gray husk that now hosted a collective intelligence of utter evil. Brand had scarcely realized the depth of his master teacher's inner strength until this awful moment.
"Come in and I'll tell you what happened and what you must do," Marcoux's ghost whispered through the voice of a body no longer his.
Well, that's a sample, and we have in the back of the book, along with articles on, you know, how I put this thing together, and how I, and Lynn's article, we also have in the back of the book, which I think though those of you who want to build worlds will find especially fascinating, is appendix number 1. The Myth of Moria and the Legendary History of Thune, by Voldestar the Truthsayer, written down in the 71st year of the Wing Chuvar, 935 A.E., under the imprimatur of Holy Church, and therefore deemed unlawful to disbelieve. And this starts out, "Thune is a world divided by the blessed intervention of Moria into 3 levels of existence, the Sky World, the Earth World, and the Cavern World. But before Thune was created, there was only Moria, and from her vast womb, all would come forth. And at the end of the beginning of time, which had lasted 777 million years longer than forever, Mother Moria gave birth to the Fire Twins, the life-giving Son of the Light, whom she named Jahl, and the destructive Lord of the Hidden Fires, whom she called Scar. And in that time, before Thune was created, and the celestial bodies were fixed in their courses, both the Fire Brothers were free to roam the heavens at will. And Jahl, being illuminated and golden, was best beloved of Moria, and he remained with his mother in the center of all, whereas Scar, whose fire smoldered under a dark veil, departed to seek the far end of the universe. And meanwhile, Jahl grew up and married his mother, begetting the fixed stars, the winds, the clouds of the sky, while his mother created an endless ocean of waters beneath the sky. And when Scar returned from his wanderings in the dark void and found that his brother had married their mother Moria, he was seething with jealous rage, but he concealed his feelings even as he veiled his light. He told Jahl of the vast wonders he had found on his journey, and while Jahl was off looking for these treasures, Scar crept upon his mother and under the cloak of his darkness, and he raped her. And from this union, Moria conceived a daughter, Thune. And in the form of the sphere of crushed rock and earth, and now Scar was so attracted to his offspring that he took up residence within her dark womb, filling her bowels and veins with his smoldering fires. But he still lusted for his mother, and yet sought to displace Jahl from her affections." And further on, so this is that was the myth of creation. And furthermore, further on, we have their own Adam and Eve. Thunar and Thunara dwelt in the hidden valley of paradise, and they gave birth to four children, two male and two female. And the angel of Zal, who ruled the lower host of heaven, was named Jalamon. And he told them that they might eat of all the fruits of the valley, save those which grew up from the moist earth after the rains, such being the riotous outgrowths of the discarded thoughts of Jal, and thus a danger to the innocent. For their innocence, man should not eat of the fallen dreams of God. And Thunar and Thunara denied the injunction, as did the first, Thunar and Thunara obeyed this injunction, as did the first pair of twins, Varka and Varkon, born in the sign of the Morian. But the second pair of twins, Dhruvan and Dhruvana, born in the sign of the Chuvar, were dissatisfied with a simple pastoral life in paradise, and they listened to the whisperings of Scar. And of course, we all know what it was that they were not supposed to eat, and it wasn't an apple. Now, let's see. So the sky isles passed over and hid them in the shadow, and they ate of the forbidden fungus, which sprang up from the cloud-born dribblings of Jal's dreams, and they saw visions and splendors and portents of horrors from times and worlds beyond knowing, and they confided their sin to their siblings, Varka and Varkana, and invited them to share in the forbidden wonders, but the elder twins wisely refused. Oh boy. Anyway, so in other words, we're paraphrasing and perhaps improving a little bit, maybe, on some of Earth's mythology. Now, one of the things that I want to point out about this is that we have in Drillmaster, we kind of have a kind of a politically incorrect hidden agenda here. This is anti-globalization. This Thune is a very delicate ecosystem, and the population must remain static, and they can't overproduce, and they can't continue to pollute, because pollution from the factories down below in the caves is ruining the sky islands, and which is the market for what they're trying to sell. And the whole thing, basically, what I'm saying, and I explain this all in the, is that globalization, the idea of taking all these third world countries and developing them as fast as possible to the point where what's going to happen if the population's explosion continues and all of these people all over the world are producing as much garbage as the average American family produces. Well, I think we can, if we look at this thing, we are creating insurmountable problems for ourselves. And this is one of the things that Drillmaster, the creation of Thune and the story and the awakening of the Mother Drell and all of this goes along this line. What? So, next week we're going to deal with another book of mine that's going to be coming out, Adamson's Quest. So we'll discuss that next week, and until then, good magic, and we'll see you then.